I hope everybody has the source sheets. We are, I hope, I think, we'll see, going to cover an entire chapter today. After, you know, needing, what, 7 weeks, 6 weeks to get through the third chapter. The fourth chapter is much more straightforward, but an awful lot to learn about. Remember that in Perek Gimel, in the third chapter, Shlomo married the daughter of Paro at the outset. We had a long discussion about that. Just how wrong was it? Was he making a mistake? You know, all the different approaches and explanations that we gave for his marriage to the daughter of Paro. Abarbanel twisting himself into a pretzel, trying to show that there was nothing wrong. Then Shlomo brings Karbanot in the Mishkan at Giv'on, leading to a vision in which Hashem promises him whatever he asks. And he asks for wisdom. He wants to know between good and bad. He wants to be able to judge the people. And that's followed by the apparent demonstration of wisdom, the story with the two women. And we spent a lot of time last week trying to figure out what exactly it was that Shlomo saw, what convinced him that this one was the right one, that this one was the wrong one. One thing I should note, just because somebody emailed me a question later on, someone who heard the shiur online, how do we know that Shlomo got it right? What if Shlomo got it wrong? So it's an intriguing possibility, but it's actually explicit in the text that it's not so. If you take a look back in chapter 3, it says specifically in sentence 26, "Vatomer ha'isha asher b'na ha'chai el ha'melech." The woman whose son was the live one said to the king, dot, 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 and she's the one who he gives it to. So it's a fun counter read, but no, it's clearly not pshat. Okay, so chapter 4, I gave you an outline at the top of the sheet, presents to us in the opening verse that Shlomo, King Solomon, is now king over all Israel. It will continue to list for us officials in Shlomo's administration. 12 officers are listed after that. They support the royal household in shifts each month. And then finally, we're told at the end of the chapter, hey, everybody's prospering. Relatively straightforward. No one appears to do anything wrong in this chapter, which is unusual, but we're not going to go looking for trouble either. We'll find trouble, because the Gemara brings trouble, but all in good time. The themes and messages here in this chapter are basically Shlomo as a great king. That's really what this is about. One of the things that's particularly interesting to me in the chapter is watching Abarbanel. This is an Abarbanel chapter. And what I mean when I say that is that there are certain specialties that Abarbanel brings to the table that other commentators simply don't have. And one of them, perhaps the best known and the most obvious, is his experience in the royal courts of Europe, right? In Italy, in Spain, in Portugal. Abarbanel is familiar with the workings of courts, and so what he's going to do every step of the way in this chapter is we're going to talk about Shlomo having certain things in his government. He says, oh yeah, that's what the Italians do, that's what the French do, that's what the Spanish do, and he's going to use words for particular positions that exist within Europe, just working with the assumption that whatever's an institution in his day must have been an institution, you know, thousands of years earlier in the time of Shlomo, right? Abarbanel, you're talking at the very end of the 15th century, that you're talking somewhere between 2,000 and 2,500 years from the time of Shlomo. Nonetheless, it's like, oh yeah, this is what kings do now, this is what kings did then. We saw something similar, if you recall, for those who are in my Thursday afternoon women's shiur, in Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud Bet. So Shmuel, after Shaul is in place as king, Shmuel gives a final speech, final public talk to the nation. And one of the things he does right at the outset is to say, judge me. Have I done anything wrong? Did I take anything from anybody? And there, Abarbanel invokes a practice which went on in Abarbanel's day. There's literature on it, in which when a king or I think even governor finished in office, or judge finished in office, it was the job of the successor to investigate him. Not like what happens today, where it's just something people take on. But no, that was actually the job. It was a formal ritual of taking office, was you have to investigate the previous one. And he says, oh, that's what Shmuel was doing. Shmuel was doing exactly that. So you're going to see that go on in Abarbanel's commentary. It's a very interesting thing to watch him do. We will have some questions to address here. I'm going to want to know, why we're cataloging Shlomo's officers, like we're listing them by name, what that's about. We're going to put a heavy emphasis in the last sentence of the chapter on the fact that everybody is eating and drinking. They're all materially. And one of the things I'm going to want to know is what that's about. Why is that our emphasis? Why are we discussing material wealth? We're going to be talking in the next chapter about building the temple, the Beis HaMikdash. Like, why are we talking about material wealth here? But I want to start out with the question that I asked at the very end last time. If you take a look in chapter 4, sentence 1 really seems to follow from chapter 3 so closely that you wonder why, when the Christians did the chapter breaks, why did they include this as sentence 1 in chapter 4? It really could have been read as the last sentence of chapter 3. Nonetheless, chapter 3 ended with everybody in awe of Shlomo's wisdom and more than a little intimidated. And then it said, "Vayhi HaMelech Shlomo Melech al Kol Yisrael." Shlomo was king over all Israel. And the question that I am asking you is the question that I ended with last time. And if you look at source number 1 on your sheet, you will see it there. If you were to flip back to chapter 2, sentence 12, right, after David gave his last instructions to Shlomo, and David died and he was buried, and we were told how long David reigned, and then we're told Shlomo is sitting on the throne, Vatikon Malchuso Me'od, and his kingdom was well established. So at that point I know Shlomo's kingdom is well established. Right? That's 3 years before what we're reading about now. 3 to 4 years before what we're reading about now. Then, the end of chapter 2, after Shlomo has done away with various enemies, whether through execution or exile or whatever, we are told once again, chapter 2, sentence 46, "V'hamamlacha nachona biyad Shlomo." The reign, the monarchy, the empire was established in Shlomo's hands. Check. So now you need to tell me, "V'hi hamelech Shlomo melech al kol Yisrael," that he is king over all Israel. What are we adding here? So two views in the commentators point to Shlomo's success in different ways. The first view is nothing is new here. This is not a new sentence at all. That's Rashi's view. It's just that it's a reaction to the wisdom that was displayed in chapter 3. This sentence really belongs in chapter 3. Rashi says it, if you look at source number 2 on your sheet, "Melech al kol Yisrael," he's king over all Israel, "Misherau bechokhmaso samchu chulam b'malchuso." When they saw his wisdom, they were really happy. This is the guy we want as a king, right? Normally, we spend our days, wondering what exactly our leaders are thinking, and not in a positive way. This is, wow. We got lucky. We actually have a king who's smarter than everybody else. Amazing. That's Rashi's way to look at it. However, Radak, Abarbanel, say there is something new here. But you have to read the sentence carefully. It says, "Vahi HaMelech Shlomo Melech al Kol Yisrael." He is king over all Israel. So Radak says, yeah, that's a reaction to his wisdom. But then they note, Dordak and Abarbanel both note, that there's actually something new here, in the sense that Shlomo is king over all Israel early in his reign. He is 3 years in, right? We've established that. But nonetheless, take a look at what Abarbanel notes in source number 3 on the sheet, please. "V'lamadnu mizeh," we learn here, "Shalohaya inyano kishaul." He's not like Shaul. Shebetchilas malchuso anshei Belial bizuhu bilavavam v'amru ma yoshienu zeh. Right? Those who learned Shmuel with me will remember this. Shmuel names Shaul as king, and people's reaction is, eh, really? That's the best you can come up with? He's not going to save us. He's not from a big family. He's not wealthy. He's not connected. That's their reaction until he surprises everybody by saving Yabesh Gilad from Ammon. Right? That makes everybody sit up and take notice, and they say, ha, if anybody says he shouldn't be king, we're going to kill them. So there. But in the beginning, no one's impressed by Shaul. V'gam lo haya k'David aviv. And also, he's not like his father David. Sha'achrei mos Shaul malach shiva shanim al shevet Yehuda bilavad velo al Yisrael. Should be Sheva. I guess the Barbanel's typo. That he's not like David either, because David, after Shaul dies, is king for 7 years only over Yehuda, not over Yisrael. Right? There's the whole story with Ishbosheth. Not clear how long during those 7 years Ishbosheth was king. That's its own discussion at the beginning of Shmuel Beis. But the point is, David also waits a long time to be king over all Israel. Omnam Shlomo lo haya king. Shlomo wasn't so. So I note for you it's somewhat imprecise, because after all, Shaul becomes king. It takes him less than 4 years. Shaul is done being king in less than 4 years. But it's true that Shlomo does not face this rocky journey that they face. That's really the point that Radak and Abarbanel are making, and that's what's being added in this sentence here. Aha! We got all Israel now. We're really in good shape. Questions, comments? Yes, Bruria. Right. And the answer is he did, and I'm not sure the point is surprise. Abarbanel has an overall theory, which we're going to see, God willing, in chapter 5 or 6, I forget exactly where. When Shlomo talks about how his father wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash and couldn't, and now I'm going to do it. So Abarbanel's theory, in brief, we'll talk about it at greater length, is that David is ineligible to build the Beis HaMikdash, not only because of wars and bloodshed and all of that, but because he starts out as a common person. And he only comes into the monarchy with struggle and process and so on. And one of the things that marks Shlomo as suited to build the Beis HaMikdash is that he started out with everything. So in other words, it's not a surprise at all, but it's a mark of his special standing, I guess is what I was
saying. So why are we discussing the word call? If he was automatically entitled to it, why do we talk about why are we saying call was such a big deal?
So I don't know.
He reigned over all.
Right, because it's a big deal that he has it. It's not a big deal that, in the sense of, he must be special, he must have done something great, that kind of thing. Although Radak does lead you in that direction by saying it's because of his wisdom. In that point, I think what you're saying does disagree with Radak.
But hang on,
Ruchama. I think that it's not so much about his wisdom as, you're right, he inherited it, and that's what gives him this position. I would, though, now I'm going to contradict everything that I just said, and point to his son, right? Rechavam is going to inherit everything that Shlomo leaves him, and it's going to go down the tubes fast. So, the fact that he got it from his father maybe does not guarantee that he will continue to have it. There is that. Ruchama.
With all what God gave him, the wisdom, and if he really took all this country that his father did, and there is still another request from them, in the Lech Bidrachai.
Right.
So until now, he is not sure how long we will live. This depends in the Lech Bechukotai.
Right, that's true. We did say that when Hashem gave him everything, Hashem said to him in chapter 3, in terms of long life, it depends on how you do. So his endurance as king is subject to his behavior. So that's a fair point as well, for sure. So Shlomo is now king, got it from his father, kept it because of his own merit, as Ruchamah notes, also as we see from the contrast with Rechabam. Perhaps the wisdom is playing into that. But yeah, I don't think it's an issue of surprise per se, as much as just a mark of his success. I think that's really what the way that I would look at it. Other notes before we go into what we're doing next? Other comments or questions on that? Okay. Then let's get...
Could it be a warning?
What do you mean?
Because we know it's going to all disintegrate in the future.
A warning because we know it's going to disintegrate. In other words, right now he has it, but don't blink.
Yeah.
Possible. You could always make that point, especially because we know the ending.
True.
You know, but I hear you. So what we're going to get next is, as I said in the beginning, a list of the members of Shlomo's administration. And just taking a fast look before we really get into who's there, you see, here are the officers. Azariahu, son of Tzadok HaKohen. He's actually either son or grandson of Tzadok. Tzadok is the Kohen Gadol, who is named in place of Abiatar, after Abiatar is deposed. And you have some other famous names that we're going to see. Benayahu ben Yehoyada, who we spent a lot of time on. I'm not going to revisit him now. Tzadok Evyasar, we'll talk about that. And then you have a bunch of people who are really unknowns, right? We don't know anything at all about them. Their claim to fame is that they show up in this chapter. Ben Deker is here. Like, okay, Ben Deker. That's a nice name, I guess. But why are we bothering to list all of these names? Those of you who learned Ezra and Nehemiah with me several years ago, remember, we were struck by that then, right? Ezra chapter 2 gave us a whole bunch of names of the Jews who came back to Israel under Zerubbabel. And that list was basically repeated, some nuances, in Nehemiah chapter 7. Right? And we asked the question, why are you giving me this list? Some of them are celebrities. But a lot of them are complete unknowns. So when we did Ezra and Nehemiah, we gave certain explanations which don't fit here. Some of the explanations there really were unique to the Ezra and Nehemiah story. But I do think we can bring two ideas from what we saw there. Number one, if you take a look at source number 4 on your sheet, this is something we saw when we learned Ezra and Nehemiah from Rabbi Elchanan Samet. Excuse me. He's talking about the list of the 70 or 69 who descend to Egypt, Yaakov's family, and how the Torah lists all of them. So he says in source number 4, lists of various types are an important and common literary phenomenon in Tanakh. And the modern reader tends to ignore them, generally for lack of interest, right? We're actually at it, this week's Parsha, right? Vayakel and Pekudei are a recap of Truma and Tetzaveh. Truma and Tetzaveh say, build this, make this. Vayakel Pekudei is, and they built this, and they made this. You know, with the punctuation of, as Hashem told Moshe, over and over and over again. Those interested in more on that, by the way, the Beit Midrash podcast for next week, for Pekudei, will be about that topic, of all the repetitions, and they did this as told, and they did this as told. So, you know, listen for that next week. But in terms of the list, he says, people generally skip them. This often has a sound objective basis. Lists of names of people or places or objects don't mean the same to us today as they meant to the reader of ancient times to whom such names were familiar and connected to his life and his environment. So he says one way to look at it is the lists were meaningful to them because they named people with names that they knew. But then he says this is only a partial explanation. The main reason for the lack of interest, you want to know why we don't read Begats? Is the change in literary taste of the modern reader as opposed to that of the ancient one, who, after all, represented the initial audience to which the Tanakh was addressed. Readers of ancient times were very fond of these lists, Some were even a sort of poetry for them. Many lists are recorded in Tanakh specifically for the purpose of introducing a more celebratory and elevated note into the, quote, routine biblical story. And some lists are poetical in nature, even in the form in which they are written in Tanakh, right? You think of Yahushua's 31 kings who he defeated, who are listed in Tanakh, in not in a prose format, but in a poem format. So that's one explanation for why we have the list. It actually, when Yirmiyahu is writing down the book of Malachim, this was something that was relevant for people. It was a literary style, and that's the way they did it. And if you don't like it, well, you can skip to chapter 5. That's the that's Rabbi Samet's answer to you. A second approach that we brought when we did the Ezra Nehemiah lists was to say those are the founding aristocrats of the nation, right? Those are the people who set in motion everything that they would have going forward, right? To borrow an expression from the U.S., they are the Mayflower families, right? They're the ones who landed. They're the ones who built things. They're the ones who are going to have streets in their name and, you know, in cities across Israel. That's what we're talking about here. And I think that works with Shlomo's reign as well. We don't know much about David's administration at all. We do get some at the end of Shmuel Beis. I shouldn't say we don't know anything. We do. But that's another way to read it. I'm going to add a third idea. Remember that Shlomo is introduced to us as Na'ar Varach. Right? He says that about himself. I am young. I am soft. There actually are commentators who suggest that when Shlomo first said, you know, take the sword, slice the baby in half, there were people who looked at him and said, oh, great, this is what happens when you make a kid king. Like, that's the best he could come up with. But what we're doing now is impressing the reader with Shlomo's administrative skill. I would not have expected, certainly if I take the Seder Olam view, that he was 12 when he took over, right? Now he's 15, 16. But even if I take Abarbanel's view, that he's like 20 when he takes over, so now he's 23, 24, I wouldn't have expected him to pull this off, to create the structure that he creates. And Abarbanel fits with this. If you take a look at source number 5, he says, Siper hakasuv sha'asa Shlomo hachana acheres lahasmadas malchuso v'kiyumo. The text told that Shlomo made another preparation, took another step that would help his reign to endure. After the step that he took in chapter 2, right, where he eliminated a bunch of people, so he's taking a step to ensure his reign will last. Bamesha sider beiso umsharsav ba'ofen shalem. He comes up with an ideal form for arranging his house, arranging his servants, such that it's going to ease the burden of leading because he has administrative help. Shlomo knows how to delegate. That's really the read here, and I think it's an important read. That's a key aspect here. Questions and comments on that? Other ideas? Yes, Joyce.
You say that they were leaders of the Kohanim or the judges of his population?
So Kohanim don't really figure into this list, even though we will see Tzadok and Abiasar on the list, and one other person who will be named as a Kohen, although we'll see whether that's literal or not. But most of them are not Kohanim. Yeah,
Can you say they were judges?
That the Kohanim were judges?
No, the list.
Oh, the list here. Right, so they're not. We're going to be told, except for one person here, all the rest of them are going to have jobs that we identify. And they're not judicial. They're really administrative. Yeah. Moish.
In advance because I lost sound for about 10 minutes, so if I repeat something, I apologize. But what strikes me from this, and I went a few seconds ahead, is do you know anybody who had these positions from the time of Moshe on?
So, no, we made the point that this is actually a new thing. I mean, no one should have these positions. These positions involve controlling sections of the land. from the time of Moshe, no one's doing that. The Shoftim, whatever their position, whether tribal or federal, did not have this kind of infrastructure at all, which is reflected in the fact that it's like each Shofet is reinventing government. They're not in sequence.
So what I want to suggest is that this is an incredible amount of transparency. Because if you even ask this class, who is the finance minister? Who's the defense minister?
We have no idea.
Well, defense minister, you know.
Oh, we shouldn't know him.
Benayahu Ben Yehoyada is the defense minister.
No, I'm saying in Canada.
Oh, in Canada?
Administration.
Who do you know? Any one of these whom you know, besides Cynthia Freeland.
But it's because they're useless. We don't
We're not going there, guys.
Honestly, you live in the greatest country in the world, so please. You know, that's really, with the greatest of respect, me, nothing personal, totally factual.
Okay. Rose, what do you got? Yeah, we're getting there. Yeah, no, we're gonna talk about that. I just wanted to discuss the presence of the lists, but now we're gonna launch into the actual officials. I just wanted to know if anybody had any questions or comments about the lists themselves. Okay. So let's talk about the first group. The first group is sentences 2 to 6. As I put there, officials in Shlomo's administration. And it's a basic list. It's not like something terribly complicated, but there are some nuances. So first of all, in sentence 2, we have, Ve'ele hasarim asher lo. Here are his officers. Azaryahu ben Sadok ha-Kohen. Azaryahu is a popular name. Uzziyahu, King Uzziyahu was also known as Azaryahu. I'm gonna ask people not to use the chat for comments about the politics and all that. Just leave it be, please. Thank you. But then you go on from Azaryahu when you have Elichoref and Achiyah, who are brothers, sons of Shisha, and they are Sopharim, they're scribes. And Yehoshaphat ben Achilud is the Mazkir. Mazkir is a term that people today use for a secretary, but we're going to talk about what these jobs are. Benayahu ben Yehoyada is over the army. Tzadok and Abiasar are in charge of the Kohanim, and so on. Then we get to the Nitzavim, which are their own thing. And the Reya HaMelech, the king's friend. What's interesting to start out with is that in sentence 2, I don't know what his job is. Azaryahu ben Sadok ha-Kohen.
Yes.
Who does what? What exactly is it that you're doing? So if you look in source number 6, Radak says, I don't know. He says, Lo kasav al miminuhu. He says the text doesn't say who he was appointed over. I don't know. He was somebody in administration. I'm sure he had a job. Or it was a nepotism thing, or he knew the right person, or whatever it was. But he was just in the government. That's all. No one really knows what he does. Peter Principal, he had just, gone up the ranks far enough that at this point it didn't matter. He's incompetent at whatever he's doing. No, that's not true. But that's, Radak says, I'm just leaving it. That's one. Abarbanel says, no, you have to read sentence 2 together with sentence 3. He says, it's Azaryahu ben Sadok ha-Kohen Elichoref ba'achiyah b'nei Shisha are all Sopharim. There are 3 scribes. Not 2 scribes, but 3 scribes. If you take a look at source number 7, you see it, I brought you there. Uminuyahu, his role, Achshom Shaya Sofer HaMelech. I think this fellow Azariah was a royal scribe. Im Elichoref Achiyah, B'nei Shisha, along with Elichoref and Achiyah. Vayu Shloshtam Soferim, and the 3 of them were scribes. Now he has a reason for saying that. He wants there to be 3 scribes, and we're going to come back to why. But this is a very difficult answer to sustain. I know he wants 3 scribes, and we're going to talk about why, but it's difficult to sustain because if you're reading the text in a text that looks like a proper text of Tanakh, then you see that there is a gap, there's a space between sentence 3 and sentence 4, suggesting that this is actually a new thought. It's not connected back to sentence 3, and that's why Radak didn't read it that way. A third approach, I see your hand, Sandra. A third approach here is an approach brought in Rashi from the Gemara. I brought it here in Rashi, but it's really, he's quoting the Gemara. I'm getting background noise, so I'm just going to do the mute thing. So that, there we go. Okay. So if you take a look at source number 8, Rashi is building off of the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Yud Beis. He says, Rav Ushmuel Pligi, their debate, the debate that you're seeing Rashi quotes, is actually based on sentence 19. Jump to sentence 19, please, first. Because otherwise what he's about to tell you won't make any sense. This is going to be the end of a list of 12 officers. And it's going to say, after naming officers and where they are, it then says, Unitziv Echad Asher Ba'aretz. And one officer who is in the land. He is anonymous, and he's not named with any particular area of land. So if you take a look at now at Rashi in source number 8, he quotes you the Gemara about that person who's in number 19, and it relates back to Azaryahu. Rav Ushmuel Pligi. Rav and Shmuel debated who this last nitziv, the last officer, is. Chad amar echad memuneh al kulam. One said, he is actually in charge of the other 12 nitzivim. And Rashi says that would be Azariah ben Natan, who we're talking about. He means ben Sadok, but it's ben Natan ben Sadok. I'm not going into that right now. But he says, that's the Azariah who we mentioned here. So when it says Azariah in our sentence, his job is to be in charge of other officers we're going to mention below. The other view in the Gemara there is that he is actually in charge of the extra month of Adar. We'll talk about that, what he means by that. It has to do with supporting the king during that month. It doesn't mean he's the court jester. But the point is, this fellow Azaryahu is listed. We do not know what his job is. Radak says, they're not telling us. Abarbanel thinks it bleeds into sentence 3. He's a scribe. Rashi thinks that based on the Gemara, he's in charge of the Nitzivin we're going to mention below. I see a hand still, but I want to go a little bit further first. And then I'll take comments and questions. So everyone who has them, just hang in there, please. What are the roles that we're describing here? So we mentioned in sentence 3, Elichoref and Achiah, and according to Abarbanel, Azariah also, are soferim, are scribes. So Rashi says, these are scribes to record chronicles. That's their job. Abarbanel says no, and here we get his explanation for why there are 3 scribes. Number 9, he says, V'yidmeh, it appears, Shehaya echad mehem sofer be'inyan ha-mishpat v'hadinim. One of them was a scribe for matters of justice and law. It's his job to write down the laws. It's his job to record the verdicts. That's what he does. V'ha'acher haya sofer hamas u'memon ha-melech v'inyanei nechasav. The second one is financial. Taxes, royal property, disposition of the king's assets. That's number 2. V'ashlishi, and the third one, haya sofer divrei hayamim v'kisvei ha-melech. He's the one who records the chronicles, all the royal decrees and writings. Those are his. Then he says to you, V'rashi kasav she'yusovim kulam kosim divrei hayamim. Rashi thought all the scribes are writing chronicles. V'asher kasav b'yani hu yoser nachom. But I know better. It's cute that Rashi said that. That's all very well and good, but I know the way this works. And the way this works is that you need sofrim doing what I said. Because that's what you need in a royal court. In a royal court, you need a scribe doing this, a scribe doing this, and a scribe doing this. That's what I've seen, and that's the way it is. So that's that's Abarbanel's take on the way this was done. Now, those are the sofrim. So what's left for the Mazkir? So Rashi says that the Mazkir is the one who controls the court docket to ensure that all the cases are going to be taken in order. Right? You have to keep track of the docket. That's Rashi. And here you get Abarbanel coming in once again with his experience. He says in source number 10, Uladati, in my opinion, Hayah mazkir hu hamemune lizkor lifnei hamelach vashoftim inyanei hamelach unachasav vahadvarim haru'uyim elav kifti hadin. He says, you want to know his job, the job of the mazkir. His job specifically is to raise the issue in front of a king and the judges of the king's needs and his assets and whatever the king is supposed to be getting. He would demand the king's interests in order for the king to make a profit. He is the, not exactly the counsel of the king, but he represents the king's interests. That's really his role. And he says, where was it? The gam hayom hazeh, today too, nimshach haminhag, we still have such a practice. Sheyia tamid bebeis hamalachim ish echad memune al zeh, that in the palaces you have somebody whose job is to do this. V'ikra'u b'lashon Edom, and in the language of Edom, by which he means Italy, Rome, right, they call him the procurator fiscal. Procurator fiscal, which I actually looked up, and on Wikipedia they actually have such a position, but there it's a Scottish position and he's doing something else. But you can look it up. But the point is, this is a person who represents the royal financial interest. That's the way that, that Abarbanel says it. Then you have in sentence five, you have the Nitzavim, in charge of the Nitzavim who stand before the king. That position of the Nitzavim is the 12 that we're going to see later. So apparently there's somebody already, Azariah ben Nasan. Oh, wait a minute. You know what? That's interesting. Okay, I made a mistake earlier, so now I can correct myself. That was wrong what I said before. When I said to you before that Rashi, which I brought you in source number 8, was referring back to Azariah, who we saw, whose job was not listed, that was incorrect. Rashi was saying it about this fellow who was in charge of the Nitzavim in sentence 5. So what that means is, to make sure that I'm saying it clearly, the Azariah in sentence 2 is either somebody with a job, we don't know what, Radak, or a sofer, according to Abarbanel. That's it. The idea in sentence 19 that we have somebody who is anonymous, who is the Nitziv Echad Asher Ba'aretz, and someone in the Gemara says he's in charge of the Nitzavim, that would make him Azariah ben Nasan in our sentence. Okay, that's clear now. I hope that I didn't confuse things too much with that. But then we also have in sentence 5, Zavud ben Nasan Kohen, Zavud ben Natan Kohen, who may not actually have been a Kohen. Abarbanel suggests it just means person of authority. Re'eh Hamelech. He is the king's friend. It's a job to be the king's friend. What are you talking about? Abarbanel in source number 12, another reference to the courts of his day. Hayam min hag hamalachim kain. This was the practice of kings. L'sheves etzlam tamid ish yishtashu imo. They would have somebody to chat with. The yochali mahem, he would eat with the kings. Kedei l'samcham uladaber alibam, to make them happy, to speak to their heart. L'galos aleihem hamalachim betach matzfunei libosam. And for the kings to be able to reveal to them what they're thinking without fear that it's going to be revealed. His job is to be a friend. And he says, yeah, that's what French kings have today. The friend of the king is a minion, which in English we call a minion. That's the origin of the word minion. It didn't come from Despicable Me movies. It didn't even come from us, from Quorum. This is the origin of the word minion. These are the minions. So the king evidently has to have a formal friend. We're almost ready for me to take comments and questions, but please, those of you who are waiting to ask questions, don't miss what I'm saying now. Then we run the risk of a loop. So that's the minion. And then in sentence 6, Achishar is in charge of the bayit. So Ralbag says, the king's household, which makes sense. Abarbanel, in source number 13, gives us yet another name for something. Yeratzeh, he says what this means is, Shahaya mimunat l'shareis es hamelach b'chol inyanei beiso. He served the king in all the matters of his household. Ulan higam kfiyah ro'oi l'avodas hamelach, directing them in ways that would serve the king. Mita v'sholchan v'kisei u'menora u'shara dvarim. Bed, table, chair, lamp. Of course, he's borrowing that from Elisha. And all other things. V'gam hayom yesh hamanoy hazeh v'batei malchei adom. He says they do that in Italy. V'nikrav l'shonam be'eretz Sfarad. And in Spain he's called Major Domo. This is the major domo of the king. You can see why I find this so entertaining. So that's what Abarbanel is telling us here. And then finally, in the end of sentence six, Adoniram ben Abda al Hamas is in charge of the taxes. Sometimes he's called Adoniram, sometimes he's called Adoram. He's gonna matter, later on this year. And this fellow who is in charge of the mas, Abarbanel says, he's not sure whether this means a collector of the taxes or a distributor of the taxes. That is not quite clear. Okay, so that's a basic list of power positions in the court of Shlomo. Sandra, you've been waiting a very long time. Go ahead, please.
Okay, I'm not sure whether this is relevant now. My question is, it was 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
But is there any significance in the order, A, of the people who are mentioned, and B, of the job?
Right. So it's a good question. It is just as relevant now, but I don't know. I have not seen anyone, you know, place a particular hierarchy on this. If I were structuring this hierarchically, I would have put Benayo ben Yehoyada Tzadok and Evyasar, right? Benayo as his right-hand man to carry everything out. We saw him in chapter 2. Tzadok and Evyasar and the Kahuna, I would have put them earlier, and I would put the scribes later. I haven't seen any commentators offer it. It's a good question, but I haven't seen it. Janine, you're responding to that point?
No.
Okay, then I'm going to take Moish, because he has also been waiting for a while.
Just a comment.
1 second, Moish first. He's been waiting. Moish?
There we go. Okay, I just want to offer two modern ways of looking at some of these positions. First of all, the multiplicity of Sofri. For those who know the Lubavitch Rebbe, I didn't know him, okay? But the story was that when he spoke on Shabbos...
Yeah, he had someone who would memorize it.
There were a multiple number of people. Not one person had to know everything. There were, I think, something between 4 and 7 people who then, at the end of the day, got together to write up the sequence. That's number one, as multiplicity. And second one, as to Boaz HaMelech, I'm going to suggest that this is about something else. And we have this in civil law, not so much anymore, but 40, 50 years ago. If you sued the king had to retain his own counsel outside the court system. So this could have been what we call it now. We have like the friend of the court. So
right.
The friend of the court who represents him when he is being sued.
It's an interesting idea. Two issues with it. Number one was the position that Abarbanel thought was taken care of by the Mazkir, the one who will mention the king's interest. But also, we have a halacha that Melech lo dan velo dan enoso. You can't judge the king. No one gets to sue the king. The executive privilege, if you like. There's no such thing as suing the Melech.
That's my point. You can't sue the king, but you can sue his buddy. So you would sue the king through the buddy.
I think that would defeat the purpose. I'm pretty sure that would defeat the purpose.
It's like a child can't have a lawsuit, but he can have a representative.
Slightly different. There's a reason for that with children, because we need people to do business with them. All right, Ruchama.
No, just a comment. Since it's written that Vayeshev Israel Avet Achish Tachat Gavno V'Tachat Te'enato Kol Yamei Shlomo. So when we say Chadesh Yameinu Kekedem, do we mean this time, the time of Shlomo?
So that's something we're going to be talking about. That's not here. We have to get to that. That's not at, at this part yet. We will get to that, God willing, but not right now. Sandra.
I also wanted to ask, did any of these ministers have any responsibility towards the wives, or did the wives have their own type of household with all of these various, or some of these various?
So we aren't, right, we aren't given enough information. What we do know, because we referenced it when we talked about Paro's daughter, is that they did not live in Ir David. Shlomo had his palace there. The wives had their own palaces outside of Ir David, which suggests a different administrative structure that they would have at their disposal. But I think a lot will depend on to what extent their roles were as wives and to what extent they were members of a harem. Yeah, I think that will probably determine it. And that has not been made clear to this point. It will become an issue in chapter 11 when we talk about their idolatry. So we may get a better sense there.
Because if you think about Megillat Esther, they talk about, you know, the queen's rescue.
Yes.
And,
right.
What did I say?
No, that's...
Esther.
No, with Vashti. And yes, there are... There are those who take care of and serve the queen there, not all the wives. It's only the queen who has that. Janine.
I just want to remember that we talked about Benayahu ben Yehoyada. He was not a Kohen, was he?
So he was a Kohen. He was a Kohen. Right, we had a whole discussion about how he can kill people if he's a Kohen. And we gave different answers.
It's funny because just a couple of weeks ago, one of my grandchildren, great Vidar Torin, talked about the Kohen Mashuach Nechama, which is the first I ever heard of it. And apparently it's not an inherited position. It's the person who's the right one to be encouraging or whatever he's supposed to be doing. Is that him?
So that may be him. It is unclear. It may be him. We did say at the time, it's not 100% clear that Kohen for him means priest. There is, again, this possibility, like we see here with the Re'eh HaMelech, that the Kohen here just means person of status. Doesn't necessarily mean priest. Okay, there's a lot to talk about still here. So I want to know, in sentence 4, what in the world is Eviasar doing there? We banished him. Right? Remember? He got in trouble. He allied himself with Adoniyahu. He already wasn't, in favor earlier. So Radak says, yeah, this is a different Eviasar. Eviasar is a name. So, there was one Eviasar, there's another Eviasar, happens to be a Kohen also. That's one approach. Ralbag and Abarbanel, though, say no. They said Tzadok could not serve as Kohen Gadol all the time. There are times when he is ineligible, which I assume is a reference to Tumah, to impurity. And so, when Tzadok is ineligible, then Eviasar will take over. I think that fits very well with Shmuel Aleph, Perek Beis. The second chapter in Shmuel Aleph, where we get the curse of the house of Eli and what's going to happen with his descendants, does not say that his descendants will die out. It doesn't even say they will never serve. They're just going to have to rely on others for their support. They join with other families of the Kohanim. So I gave you the reference to it on the sheet in source number 14, but I'm not going to call it up right now. You can look at it yourselves. But I think it's true. I think Eviasar does not disappear. He's still on the scene. He's not empowered the way he once was, and it's a big come down for him. But I think that's the accurate read of what's going on here. Okay, major note here, and this is what I meant before when I said the Gemara is going to get us into trouble. If you look at sentence 3, Elichoref and Achia, the sons of Shisha, are Sopharim. They look like nice people, right? There's nothing in particular that stands out. They're Sofrim. They write stuff, right? Whether that's where they write courts or financial documents or whatever, you can debate. If you're a Barbanel, you say one thing. If you're Rashi, you say another thing. I have no idea what they did to deserve source number 15. Take a look at the Gemara in Sukkah. Tarte Kushoi, Dabukaimi Kame Shlomo. There were two Kushim in front of Shlomo. Kushim, literally, Ethiopians. However, Rashi tells you that what it means here are handsome people. And I think he has to say that because there's no idea here, there's no notion here that people would be identified if they were Jewish as being from Kush. It doesn't really fit. So he says, these two attractive men, Elicharef and Achia, Bnei Shisha, so from the Shlomo Avu, they're the scribes of Shlomo. Yomachad, Chazi Lamalach HaMavis Dava Ka'atzib. Shlomo sees the angel of death is very upset. Right? Because when you're Shlomo, you get to see things like that. So Shlomo sees that the angel of death is in a bad mood. Amarle, Amaya Tzivas. He says, what are you upset about? Amarle, De Kabo Minai, Hani Tarte Kushoi, De Atzviyach. He says, you see those two guys? I'm supposed to claim them. Masrinhu L'Si'irim. So Shlomo hands them off to demons. What does Shlomo have to do with demons? We'll see more about that, God willing, in chapter 5 and again in chapter 11. But right now, just take the story the way the Gemara is telling it. Shlomo hands off these two guys to demons. Shadrinu L'Mechoza de Luz. And he sends them to the city of Luz. Why the city of Luz? Anybody know? It's a Gemara in Sota. So the city of Luz, according to the Gemara in Sota, I think it's Membez, I'm looking at my notes, no, Membav, sorry, is a city in which people don't die. They get old, and when they get tired of living, then they leave the city, and then they die. But they don't die in the city itself. So he says, I'm going to thwart the Malach HaMavis. He wants to take them? No way, I'm sending them to Luz. Kimadu l'mechosa de Luz, shchivu. But right when they arrive at Luz, they die. Right as they're entering the city. Lamachar chazya malach hamavis davakabadach. The next day, Shlomo sees the angel of death is happy. He's in a good mood. Amalei amai betichas. He says, what are you so happy about? Amalei ba'aser debo minoi taman shadar tinu. He says, yeah, because I was supposed to get them in Luz. I didn't know how it was going to happen. And you sent them right there for me. Miyad pasach Shlomo va'omar ragloid bar inish inun arvin bay la'asar de mizbi taman movilin yasei. Shlomo immediately declares the legs of a person are his guarantors. They bring him to the place where he is demanded. You've heard stories like this before, right? So that's the Gemara. The Yerushalmi has a slightly different version of it. It takes out the Luz component. If you take a look at source number 16, Elichoref va'achia train iskav tiri de Shlomo. Now they're not Kushoi, they're just Shlomo's scribes. Chama Malach Mosa, Mistakobon Vacharik Bishinoi. Shlomo sees the Malach HaMavis looking at them and grinding his teeth. Amar Mila Vyahabun Bachalala. So Shlomo says a word, he says something, whatever, it doesn't have to be a word literally, and he puts them up in the atmosphere. They're now floating up in the air. That's one commentator on the Yerushalmi reads it that way, another one says they're inside the earth. It doesn't matter for our purposes. Adla v'naswin min taman. So the Malach HaMavis goes and gets them from there. Asa kram le gachach lekiv le. And then he comes back and he's laughing at Shlomo. Amar le hahi shaita havesa ichok v'shinyach chudonat gachach lon. He says, what, you were angry before and now you're laughing at us? What's going on? Amar le, to which the Malach HaMavis says, Rachmana amar diyintzav le'alichore v'achiyah min chalala. He says, yeah, God told me I should get them from space. The Amrit man yoev li elain lahain the ishtalchis misvinan. He says, I didn't know how in the world they were going to get there, that I should go get them there. How am I going to do my job? The yoev belibach lemeav kain begin to navich lichusi. He, I assume that means God, put it in your heart that you should do my, that I should be able to carry out my job. Azal the itzvil bones zaman taman. And Shlomo went and he took care of their bodies there. He buries them. Okay, they look like nice people, the Elichoref and Achia. Like, where did you pull this from? Like, how did this have anything to do with anything in our chapter? I mean, I could ask you, and we could sit here staring at each other for the next 5 minutes because it's totally bizarre. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, who was an authority in many things. We're talking 12th century Germany now. wrote a book called Sefer Gematriot, which has a lot of things in it, not just Gematria. And what I brought you in source number 17 comes from there. I didn't translate it because it's a train wreck to translate. He points out that here their father's name is Shisha. However, in Shmuel Bet, chapter 20, sentence 25, we find out that their father was a scribe for David. And his name there is Shav, empty. So he suggests, and you could see it there in source number 17, that the idea is that trying to outsmart the Malach HaMaves is empty. You can't get away with it, and he gives you a reference to the pasuk that Shlomo will say in Koheles, Ein Shilton B'yom HaMaves. There is no power on the day of death. You can't outwit the Malach HaMaves. I think that's it's definitely a lesson here. I think it's hard to say that that's the basis for all we picked on Elicho, Ref, and Achiyah. I hunted around online, and I found someone who made a comment on a message board on dafyomi.com. And I thought, wow, that's pshat. That's totally what's going on. He says, go back to sentence 3 in chapter 4. The sentence that mentioned Elichoref and Achiyah. This is as close as I'm going to get to an explanation for why we're picking on these two guys. Yehoshaphat ben Achilud Hamazkir. Yehoshaphat means God judges. Right? The Yeho, beginning of a name, is a reference to Hashem. That's always true. And then Shaphat is to judge. God judges. Achi, the two brothers, Lud, go to Lud. Now, you'll say, but it's Luz, not Lud. But remember that Zions and Dalids get interchanged a lot. So Zachar is male in Hebrew, and Dachar in Aramaic. Zions and Dalids go back and forth. So the God judges the brothers who go to Luz. And the Gemara wants it to be Luz because that's the place where people don't die. So that's his idea of where this could possibly come from. I thought that was very clever. As a way to explain this, because I got nothing else. The idea of it is just strange, but it, one thing that is clear that emerges from this Gemara, the Bavli version, the Yerushalmi version, is it's a Musar lesson, right? This is a lesson regarding Shlomo's arrogance. Embedded in a chapter about his administrative brilliance, we get a lesson in arrogance. Hey, Shlomo, you think you're in control. Look what happens. You know, you think you can outwit the Malach HaMaves, and you cannot. Clear? Not so clear. Joyce is saying to me, no, that's not clear at all. What is this story about? Why them? I'm with you. I don't know either. I couldn't not present this story, but honestly, I'm with you. I feel like I need more information. So
just to ask, the names of these people, it's completely irrelevant? Is that what
we're doing
now?
Yeah, really.
Okay.
I would like to be able to say something else, but I can't think of anything else. Bruria, yeah.
Are they mentioned? Is the fact that they were killed or they died mentioned anywhere other than the Gemara?
No. We got nothing.
The only place we have is in the Yerushalmi. The only place we have is in the Sukkot. The
Bavli and the Yerushalmi that I brought you. Yeah. That's
and
it.
How do they connect to there? Like, what's the connection?
That's, the Gemara doesn't, oh, how is it connect in context?
Yeah.
So the Yerushalmi is in Kilayim and also in Ksuvos, and I don't remember what the...
I just wonder how they got that.
Right, I don't remember in those two. The Bavli and Sukkah there is the whole discussion about the Yetzer Hara. That's the principal discussion in Shas about the Yetzer Hara is in that Sukkah. Also, the Malach HaMaves is there, like, the, it's, yeah. But I have
no... So interesting in terms of the traction it has as a story.
Yeah, I've heard this story before. Outside of the context of the Gemara. And the Gemara is bringing it here. It's such a strange story. There's got to be more to it, and I just don't know what it is. The
Emi Hara. I don't know if I'm mistaken, but Hara means to get angry at, or to...
It can mean a few different things. It can mean to be sharp. It can mean to blaspheme.
So with, his name, could that be a hint that he did something bad and that's why they started talking about this?
And Achiyah, his brother?
Well, I'm only trying here.
Yeah, like me. I don't know. I'm just
one
stuck.
One was good and one was bad. Maybe one of them made the other one bad.
Achiyah
sounds like he was a good guy.
Or a co-conspirator.
Yeah, I don't know. We could do whatever we like with this story because there's just, it's such a canvas. But there's no evidence to work with. I don't know. All right, we did not get through the whole chapter.
Going through my mind, I think it was with the city of Beitel, it was Luz Shemha Yirkat Chala.
Barishona, yeah. That's when it shows up early in the Torah.
The same Luz that they're talking about?
Possibly. This Luz gets its name because of a story in Shoftim, in which the Jews are laying siege to the city, to a city, and then there's somebody in the city who shows them how to get in, and then he leaves. The Jews invade and destroy the city, but they let him go, and he founds the city of Luz. That's this city. All right. There's more to be said, as always. Maybe if people come up with an idea in the next week and want to talk about it in the beginning next time, to explain this story, I'll be open to hearing it. Next week, God willing, we'll wrap this chapter, and then things get into high gear with chapter 5. And the start of, Shlomo's wisdom will be described at length, and we'll also see the start of the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. Thank you very much, everybody.